Before we get going, here's the bit where I remind you that nothing we discussed should be considered as investment advice. This conversation is for informational and hopefully entertainment purposes only. So while we hope you find it both informative and entertaining, please do your own research or speak to a financial advisor before putting a dime of your money into these crazy markets. And now, on with the show. Welcome, everybody, to another edition of the Grant Williams podcast. Joining me shortly is the author Raymond Baker, who has written a fantastic book called Invisible Trillions: How Financial Secrecy is Imperiling Capitalism and Democracy and the Way to Renew Our Broken System. It's a fascinating book filled with an enormous amount of information and statistics that, as I was reading it, even though I kind of deep down knew how big the problems were, made me realize that it's a lot bigger than I thought. Raymond has a fascinating background, which we'll get into early. But without further ado, let's jump into my conversation with Raymond Baker. Raymond, welcome to the podcast. Thank you so much for taking the time. It's a real pleasure to meet you and to have read your fabulous book, Invisible Trillions.
Thank you, Grant. Looking forward to talking with you about that and other global topics and issues.
Absolutely. So, look, it is a fascinating story, and we'll spend the majority of this time talking about that. But I think it's always a good idea to set the stage and give people a sense of your background and how your life unfolded before you got to becoming an author and before you took this particular project on.
I finished Harvard Business School in 1960. I didn't know what I wanted to do. I decided to get a taste of international business. Went to Nigeria, took a job managing a company owned by the foreign minister. After a couple of years of that, I decided I could set up on my own and did so just about in time to get hit by the Nigerian Civil War, the Biafran conflict. Married, continued in Nigeria, but I pretty soon, by about 1966, figured out I'm playing a zero-sum game here. I'm either gonna make it or I'm gonna fall flat on my face and go back to America and never admit it, one or the other. So I decided that I would stick it out, and I started buying small and medium-sized companies that I could afford to buy that people who were smarter than me were selling out. And by the end of the Civil War, I had two manufacturing companies and a trucking business. And I had a consulting company that I had set up. And then we created a financial holding company and borrowed a lot of money and expanded our business. It all worked out very, very well. Continued to live in Nigeria until 1976, moved back to the States. I did business all over the world, export business, and finally decided, you know, I've seen enough financial skullduggery to last a lifetime. I got to say what I want to say about this. So I segued into the think tank world, became a guest scholar at the Brookings Institution, and wrote my first book. That's the long and the short of it.
Well, there's about three separate podcasts in there. I mean, there's a whole 3 or 4 hours on your experiences in Nigeria, I'm sure. So we'll have to get you back one day to talk about that, because I bet that is an absolutely fascinating story. And when you came to write Invisible Trillions, what was the motivation behind it? And what was the kind of picture you were trying to paint and the story you were trying to get across to people?
I published an earlier book called Capitalism's Achilles Heel.
Yeah.
In 2005. In 2006, I founded an organization called Global Financial Integrity, which, of course, is a very optimistic idea, but we set out on the path of trying to get a higher degree of propriety in financial transactions. We've been flogging that for more than 15 years and not making as much progress as we wanted to make. We and a lot of other civil society organizations have been pursuing this kind of agenda, seeing some progress, but not as much as we think needs to be made. And I finally decided I needed to write a second book. And the motivation for the second book stems from the fact that a number of us in this space have been pursuing particularistic issues, such as beneficial ownership and human trafficking and drug trading and money laundering, aspects of these issues. And as I say, not making as much progress as we wanted to make. So I decided what needs to be done is to elevate these issues to a higher level. We need to understand that in sum, we are dealing with an existential threat to the democratic capitalist system. And that was the driving motivation behind Invisible Trillions, trying to elevate these issues to a higher level of concern.
It's fascinating to read the book because this is a situation and a problem that I think all of us who inhabit the financial waters understand. We understand it's a problem. We understand it's a real issue, but it's tough to quantify. And you did a great job in the book of really making even me, who's a born skeptic and has only grown more skeptical as the years have gone by, putting it into perspective and understanding the vast sums of money at stake here and the kind of ubiquity of this problem. We kind of think sometimes it's very much a kind of third world problem or a banana republic problem when the truth is very far from that. So if you can, just paint an overall picture of the landscape as it is right now and where you see the major problems.
The issue that I address in my book is the whole gamut of financial secrecy. Capitalism has gone through a fundamental change in the last half century. And that is, capitalism has added secrecy to its motivations. The original motivation was just earning a profit. But since the early 1960s, we've begun to add secrecy to it, to the point that financial secrecy mechanisms are now involved in perhaps half of global financial transactions. That is to say, transactions that pass through tax havens and secrecy jurisdictions and disguised corporations and so forth. Secrecy has become as powerful a motivation within capitalism as profitability itself. That's the overarching issue that draws me into this subject matter, because it is so different from what I grew up with, what I studied at Harvard, what I believed. The world has changed radically. The greater part of the change in the democratic capitalist system, in my opinion, has occurred in its capitalist component rather than its democracy component.
Yeah, you know, you make a great point early in the book, and that is the distinction between secrecy and privacy. And I think that's such an important one for people to understand, because there is so much debate around privacy right now in the world and who has it and who deserves it and who's trying to take it away. But you're right, what we're talking about here is something completely different, and that is secrecy. Let's talk about the structure that has built up to try and ensure secrecy for corporations, because it's ubiquitous.
There is a multifaceted structure that has been built up, as you are suggesting. It comprises tax havens. In the early 1960s, there were only three or four tax havens around the world. There are now somewhere between 75 and 150, depending on how you count. Secrecy jurisdictions, places where you can establish entities that hide behind lawyers and accountants, and nobody knows who owns those entities. Disguised corporations in the tens of millions around the world, and incidentally, more of them having been created in the United States than in any other country. We've got fake foundations. Grant, you can establish a foundation. You can donate your money to your charitable foundation, and you can designate yourself as the beneficiary of the charity of your foundation, dodging taxes all along the way. And then we've got all sorts of money laundering techniques. But there's something that sits in the middle of this financial secrecy system, and that is falsified trade.
Yeah.
One of the key things that's happened in the capitalist system over the last half century is that the concepts of price and value have become completely separate ideas. Price is what you put on the invoice. That doesn't have to represent anything close to value. So you can move money across countries by manipulating the invoice, which does not have to represent value at all. with that sitting in the middle of the financial secrecy system, that's what accounts for the fact that perhaps half of global transactions pass through the financial secrecy system, somewhere between initiation and completion.
Yeah, it's so fascinating. I say there were so many eye-opening moments for me reading the book, and this was absolutely one of them. And I think, you know, this idea of trade, we all talk about money being moved illicitly around the world. Everybody instantly goes to money launderers and drug dealers and all this kind of stuff. But we don't really think about seemingly legitimate trade and how that can be used to funnel money around the world. So, and can you put some kind of perspective on just how big a problem that is?
There are three components of dirty money: corrupt, criminal, and commercial. Through 40 years of my career, having lived in the developing countries, having done business all over the world, I was under the impression that the corrupt component, and by that I mean money stolen by government officials, I thought that was the biggest part of the problem of the cross-border flow of illicit money. The criminal is big, and the commercial, I didn't know how big it was. But I thought the corrupt component was the biggest. In 1997, I did a project where I interviewed 335 finance ministers, revenue collectors, security guys, journalists, bankers, business people in 23 countries around the world, thinking that the corrupt component was the biggest of the three components, and I wanted to establish that. I came out of that investigation realizing that in the cross-border flow of illicit money, the corrupt component, that which is stolen by government officials, is the smallest part of the problem.
Yeah.
And the commercial component is by far the bigger part of the problem. The decades I had been in international business, that was a correction for me to understand that of the three components, the corrupt is the smallest, the criminal is next, and the commercial is by far the largest part of the three components of dirty money.
But, I mean, can you put some numbers on this for the folks listening? Because, you know, in the book, you go to great length to lay out the just sheer size of these problems. And the book's called Invisible Trillions, which is a great clue. But still, when you break it down, it's still pretty eye-watering.
I would roughly estimate the corrupt component of cross-border flows at $20 to $40 billion a year. It may be a little bit larger than that now, depending on how you define China, whether you define state-owned corporations as part of the corrupt component or part of the commercial component. But $20 to $40 billion a year would not be a bad figure for theft by direct government officials. The criminal component, we put that at about $2 trillion a year. The commercial component, oh, I've seen figures in the tens of trillions for the commercial component because such a high percentage of commercial transactions have a component of misinvoicing for the purpose of shifting money across borders. But we're talking about tens of trillions of dollars annually.
Yeah, I mean, can you characterize that cross-border trade component? I think it's helpful to give some examples of how that works, because for most people, they tend not to think about that as a potential source of corruption. We think of trade as trade, and we look at guys in back rooms getting envelopes, whether in the government or they're passing illicit substances across borders. But talk a little bit about the methods used to obfuscate these transactions.
Well, basically, it's manipulating invoices. Now, let's suppose you're a business person sitting in Kenya and you want to get money out. You're in the import-export business in Kenya. All you have to do is call up your export supplier in Europe and say, on the rest of my transactions for this year, I want you to add 15% to the price. And then when I pay the total invoice, you'll take that 15% and put in my London bank account. It just takes a phone call. It takes two people to cooperate in the process. But all it takes is a phone call to say, misinvoice that transaction or those transactions. And when you get the money, put it in my bank account. That's all it takes. It's the difference between what's on the invoice as compared to what's the real value of the transaction.
We've seen various leaks recently in the last few years, and I guess the most prominent in people's minds, mainly because they made a film featuring Meryl Streep about it, was the Panama Papers. And of course, that was, again, a revelation for those of us who chose to follow the story and read the stories behind the headlines. You know, like a lot of things in this day and age, there was a big explosion of headlines about the story. And then it just gets kind of arcane enough that people, they go, oh my God, there's an awful lot of fraud going on. But if you want to really understand it, that's a lot of reading. That news cycle lasted several weeks, so you have to stay current on it, which most people don't do. With the best will in the world, they just don't. They've got busy lives and they're distracted by other things. So talk a little bit about the Panama Papers and what that did for the understanding of the size of this problem and also the kind of main things that uncovered.
The Panama Papers and a lot of other exposés stem from the work of the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, ICIJ, headed by Gerard Ryle, with whom I've shared a number of interactions. Our two organizations are two sides of the same coin, if you want to speak. They focus on exposés based on the revelations coming out of documents, and they've done a brilliant job of this. The Panama Papers listed countless government officials, countless foreign dignitaries, movie stars, and what have you, that have used the offshore structure to evade or avoid taxes, depending on what word you want to use. But they've done a terrific job of that. They've gone on with the Paradise Papers. They've gone on exposés in Angola, FinCEN, the Financial Crimes Enforcement Network in the United States, was excoriated. They've done a terrific job. But as you say, sometimes it has a news cycle and then it sort of disappears. One of the people that I've interacted with, Ralph Nader, who has focused on these kinds of issues one time, sitting next to me on the podium, he said, you know, we're getting close to expose overload. We're hearing this all the time. It's becoming normalized, and it shouldn't, but we're becoming so used to it. That, again, is part of the reason that I've written my book, is to say, don't get overloaded, because it is an existential threat going forward. I think the world of the work of ICIJ, they're very, very good. And in effect, global financial integrity has tried to be a thought leader in this process. ICIJ has worked the turf to expose the realities of these problems. To some extent, we're two sides of the same coin. I think their work is terrific. And I had lots of interactions with them and wish them well every time.
So as you've gone through the process of researching and then writing this book, what changes have you seen in the approach to trying to at least make a dent in this problem? Because, again, it's one of those issues that to anybody looking at it casually, it just seems like such a big problem. And the numbers are so big and it's global in nature. And I think people look at it and go, well, how could you possibly do anything about that? Because it's just so big, there's nothing we can do. Have you seen during your process of conceptualizing and publishing the book any change in the way this is being attacked as a problem?
There is progress. It is not as aggressive as it should be, but there is progress. The organization I founded, first conversation I had with the managing director I hired, who is now the head of the of Global Financial Integrity, Tom Cardamone, first conversation we had was, we can't call this stuff dirty money, which was the subtitle of my book, Capitalism's Achilles Heel. We can't call this stuff dirty money, because that'll make people go running for the exit. You know, bankers and lawyers and accountants will go tearing out of the room. So we understood that we had to call this something else. And after a lot of thought, do we call it corruption? Do we call it money laundering? Do we call it tax? We finally decided to call it illicit financial flows. That sounds much more sophisticated,
right,
and
right.
A little less offensive too, but it's the same thing. And so, yes, we secured the terminology illicit financial flows into the global agenda. There's been some progress. The United States is beginning to address the question of disguised corporations. The UK has begun to address the question of disguised corporations. One key element of the financial secrecy system has been taken completely off the table, and that is the element of shell banks, disguised banks,
yeah,
used to be part of the financial secrecy system. And in the Patriot Act, passed in October 2001, the section on anti-money laundering took shell banks off the table just like that. It says it is illegal for any U.S. bank to receive money from a foreign shell corporation. It goes on to say it is illegal for any other financial institution in the world to send money to the United States that it has received from a shell bank. And it made it very clear this refers to wire transfers that might touch a correspondent banking account in New York, yep, for just a moment before splitting off somewhere else. In other words, it was a flat-out prohibition against dealing with shell banks, and it worked. Shell banks were gone in a matter of weeks, and I mean gone. Part of the reason I stress this is to make it clear that every single element of countering the financial secrecy system is a matter of political will.
Yeah.
That's all it is. It's political will. If we have the will to do it, we can do it. We could get rid of disguised corporations in exactly the same way by saying you can't receive money from a disguised corporation. It's all a matter of political will. And I make this point in part, Grant, because a lot of people, particularly bankers and accountants, will tell you, oh, no, these problems are very complicated. You don't understand how complicated they are. Forget that one. These problems, yeah, are a matter of political will. It's a matter of political will to curtail the realities of the financial secrecy system.
Yeah, and I think to a lot of people that's obvious that it is a matter of political will. And that kind of inevitably funnels you towards the question, because obviously government corruption is a part of these flows. As you say, the smallest part, but it's considering the small number of politicians there are in the world relative to the population, per head, it's a pretty big number. And one can't help but think, well, okay, why is there no political will? If this is such a simple thing to stop, and you've just laid out a perfect example there with shell banks. Obviously, that required the largest act of terrorism in history to galvanize everybody to put that through, but put it through they did. And so one can't help but wonder, with a jaded eye around politics and politicians, what are the motivations for them not putting a simple stop to this and not capping these things off? And does that bring us into that realm of government corruption, whereby it's not in their interest to put a stop to this? It serves a purpose to talk about it and to jawbone and to make statements and grandstand in committees and on C-SPAN and make it look like you're standing up and being tough. But at the end of the day, you run it through the political machine, knowing full well it's not going to go anywhere.
My first book, Capitalism's Achilles Heel, Part 1, is entitled Illegality. And the subtitle of Part 1 is We Like the Money. It's just that simple, Grant. We like the money. The money flows from other places into our economies, into the United States, into the UK, into other European countries, or maybe Singapore, or where have you. But we like the money that flows endlessly out of those economies. The United States has the biggest trade deficits of any country in the world, so we need to balance our trade deficits. So we throw the doors open to dirty money and very haltingly and slowly get our heads wrapped around trying to curtail the problem. But the simple answer is, and the correct answer is, we like the money that flows from other places into our economies. I hope that we can eventually get to the point that we realize that it is counterproductive for us rather than productive.
You know, it's funny, when you talk about we like the money and you talk about money coming to the US there, one of the things in the book that I won't say surprised me, but it certainly crystallized in my mind in a much more vivid way, something that I knew was a problem. And that is the jurisdictions that are the biggest in this stuff. Because I live in the Cayman Islands, and every time you say that name, when people say, oh, where do you live? You say the Cayman Islands, you know, at least one eyebrow goes up, possibly two. And you get this look like, oh, yeah, Cayman Islands, eh? As if the fact that you live there means that you're either avoiding tax or evading tax or you've got some dodgy scheme going on. And, the BVI and Vanuatu and the Seychelles and Mauritius and all these places which we all know and sadly for them associate with money laundering and tax evasion, all these things. The one place that never really gets talked about is the United States. And, you know, I know that between Delaware and Montana and all these various places in the US, Dakotas, there are all kinds of shell corporations. But reading the book really helped me understand just how big this industry is in the United States. So perhaps from the ground up, you could build a picture of the United States' role in this, because I think it'll surprise an awful lot of people just how big it is.
Over the past 30 years or so, have facilitated the establishment of more disguised corporations than any other country in the world. Perhaps something on the order of $2 million a year for years and years and years. Even Janet Yellen, the Secretary of the Treasury in the United States, said the United States is the preferred destination for dirty money coming in, for illegal money coming out of one place into another country. She said that herself. And that is the case. We have all sorts of ways that we can go about receiving that money. Let me give you an example. When a U.S. bank sees money coming in that it thinks looks a little bit dodgy or a little bit suspicious, whether it's criminal or tax evading or money laundering or what have you, it is required to file a suspicious activities report or a currency transaction report. Now, you would think this would be an occasional process. You'd think the banks would be on top of this and turning down that money before it ever really got into an account. Can you imagine how many suspicious activities reports and currency transaction reports are filed? On average, 80,000 a day. What that means is U.S. banks will find some reason to take just about every dollar that shows up across the transom and just file a suspicious activities report. There is no way to curtail laundered money, criminal money, corrupt money coming into the United States when the banking system simply takes it and files a report so that the overwhelmed U.S. financial intelligence agency can't deal with it. I asked the head of the U.S. financial intelligence agency years ago, do we do a very good job of curtailing illicit money coming into the United States? And this was some years ago. At that time, he said, I estimate about $250 billion a year comes into the United States. And it's much bigger now. And I said, okay, $250 billion coming in. How much do we succeed in identifying and going after? He said, about $250 million a year. I did a quick calculation. $250 billion coming in, $250 million. 99.9% of the dirty money gets into the U.S. banking system easily. I don't think that ratio has changed at all. It may have worsened since the years when that head of the Financial Crimes Intelligence Network, the U.S. Financial Intelligence Agency, told me that. No, we're virtually wide open to the illicit money coming in and have not done a good job of trying to curtail that. A further point that I could make about that, Grant, the Treasury Department is somewhat split on this question. There are some people in the Treasury Department that want to go after corrupt money and kleptocrats' money and drug money and so forth really hard. And there are other parts of the Treasury Department that say, our main job is to try to curtail the U.S. trade deficit. So the two sides of the hall fight with each other. And as a consequence, Treasury Department is not very good in addressing these problems.
That's such an interesting point, you know, and it's not one I think that many people consider, is that this actually performs a useful service. Having this money come into the United States, as you say, at a time when the deficits are the biggest they've ever been, actually makes an awful lot of sense. But you know, beyond the flows, again, there's this idea that shell corporations and entities that are used to hide the beneficial owners and avoid tax. Everyone thinks that that's a British Virgin Islands problem or a Cayman Islands problem, but there's nowhere in the world bigger than the United States. So again, perhaps you could talk a little bit about that, because I think this will come as a big surprise to an awful lot of people, because it doesn't get the kind of coverage that these foreign-sounding tax paradise Caribbean havens get in any way, shape, or form.
Years ago, the state of Delaware was the favorite place to set up an entity where you didn't have to identify who were the owners of the entity. Based on the Delaware model, over the past, 40 years or so, every state in America created opportunities to set up disguised corporations. So there is no state that didn't do so. Every part of the United States made it possible to do that, all competing with Delaware, trying to outdo Delaware, to the point that some states have made it possible to set up disguised entities in perpetuity that cannot be identified. The United States has led the way in some aspects of this. And you're right. And I have said this to audiences of thousands. We, for years, have liked to point to those corrupt countries over there that are responsible for all of this theft and money laundering and crime and so forth. Well, just about every dollar that comes out of those corrupt countries over there ends up in the United States or the UK or Europe or some other jurisdiction, and we take the money. We like the money. It's just that simple.
In the second part of the Invisible Trillions, you call that title Corroding the Commons, which I thought was such an interesting way to frame that part of the discussion. So perhaps you could talk about what you meant by corroding the commons, because I think once I'd read it, I thought, man, that is such a perfect phrase for what you describe here.
That section goes into banks and corporations and auditors and so forth. The degree to which we are conducting the affairs of capitalism so as to foster crime and corruption and kleptocracy, all of which are terrible ills to have to deal with. But Grant, the biggest part of the corroding of the commons is the impact that it has on economic inequality. This is what is driving the seriousness of the problem. We operate a system, the purpose of which is to move money from criminal to legitimate, from corrupt to respectable, and from poor to rich. That's the purpose of the financial secrecy system. It's not a extraneous after effect. That's the purpose of the system. And all that it does to crime and corruption, the biggest impact is on economic inequality. When I graduated from Harvard Business School in 1960, the ratio of executive pay to workers' wages was 20 to 1. Guess what it is now? More than 350 to 1.
Yeah.
The disparity has exploded in the United States. Not all of that is due to the financial secrecy system, but a good part of it is due to the financial secrecy system. The biggest impact of this system is on democracy itself. We have so separated rich and poor that it's having an impact on our commitments to democracy. I've argued this point with a lot of people, and I have asked, tell me how you strengthen democracy amidst continuously rising inequality. No one has ever given me an answer. I don't think anybody's going to give me an answer. Curtailing inequality isn't the only thing that needs to be done for democracy, but it is an essential component of strengthening democracy.
Well, you segmented me perfectly into what I wanted to come on to, which, as you hinted at there, is arguably the most important component of this particular topic, and that is the damage that the kind of corruption of capitalism is doing to democracy. And as you look at the last kind of 20-odd years, as we've seen this low interest rate environment which has been perpetuated for way too long, and the accelerant effect that that's had on this divide between rich and poor that you talk about, we've reached the point now where everywhere you look in society, things are, let's not say they're breaking, but you can see the strain that they're under, and it's left against right, it's rich against poor, it's whichever way you want to look at it, there is division. And ultimately, you come back to money on this, and a lot of people don't join those two dots together, that you know, money is about trust. And if you corrupt the flow of money and you corrupt money itself, which is what a lot of these policies have done, you undermine trust across society. And so how are people supposed to build this bridge back when it's trust that's gone? Because it's such a difficult thing. And in the last part of the book, you talk about what you call, I think, the precarious state of democratic capitalism. And it feels like we're at that moment where capitalism has been really kind of stolen. And that is now having knock-on effects with democracy, which is the system that we realize, I think, in the cold light of day is better than any other system we've had to come up with. Talk a little bit about how this financial corruption is corroding capitalism, and then perhaps get into some of the suggestions about how we might be able to try and bridge that wealth divide in a system that actively attempts to broaden it.
When I entered the business world, I won't say that I felt this. In retrospect, I think I realized that capitalism and democracy were working pretty well together. There was a measure of sync between the two. Capitalism was driving prosperity. Democracy was driving equality in the political arena. But I've watched these two realities now drawing apart, becoming decoupled. A lot of people think that you can have capitalism without democracy. You can maintain capitalism and drift toward authoritarianism, and that's all right. I don't think it's all right. I think the capitalist system is dependent upon democracy. If the democratic capitalist system loses its capitalism component, I think it'll take democracy down with it. This is what's happening in so many countries around the world that have turned toward authoritarianism. I've never known an authoritarian country that didn't have massive amounts of theft, kleptocracy at the highest levels. We're risking democracy itself with the machinations within the capitalist system. And I make this point because a lot of people think that the troubles within democratic capitalism are primarily in its democracy component. I don't agree with that. I think it's primarily in its capitalism component. That's the component of this that has to be strengthened. Give me a more equal economic environment, and much of the problems that we have in democracy will begin to weaken, and we can find again the unity that is necessary to make both parts of our system work.
Yeah, it's such a good point. I couldn't agree with that more. But what's interesting to me is that, as you say, that's the capitalism part of this is essential for democracy to function. And we've seen what can happen to nations when those two are working in sync. As you said, you can experience extraordinary growth, extraordinary improvements in standard of living. But to fix the capitalism side of that, it's ultimately a legislative and regulatory task because, look, human nature is never going to change. And so if people have a chance of making some easy money and it's a little bit gray, a lot of people are going to take that. So how do we restore the integrity, at the risk of stealing one of your chapter titles, how do we restore integrity to the capitalist system when it seems as though the legislative side of this are, I won't say bought and paid for, but they're certainly incentivized to drag things out or look the other way. And the regulatory side of things are completely overwhelmed. The example you gave of all those reports is just one. But if you look at how outmanned and outgunned the SEC are and how the arms race is proving it impossible for them to keep up with the ways people are finding to get around this stuff, what's the way that this can be brought back together without some kind of awful event happening that we don't really want to contemplate?
I draw my answer to that question from the way that climate change has been addressed. During the 1970s and 80s and 90s, scientists and experts knew that global warming was a reality, that we had all sorts of pollutants that were heating up the world, and so forth. And they got nowhere trying to address this issue. Finally, it took Al Gore to come along and say, you know, this is more than a series of little statistical dots on the scientific agenda. This is an existential threat to the future of humankind. And with his emphasis, with his films, with his speeches, with his Nobel Peace Prize, he drove this issue into the global consciousness. Now the world is attuned to the fact that global warming is a reality and we have to address it as an existential threat. I'm not Al Gore, but I'm trying to take the lesson from that in my book and make it clear that we're dealing with an existential threat. We're not dealing with a lot of little issues along the way. We're dealing with a systemic threat to the democratic capitalist system, and we have to address it as a systemic threat. That's what I'm trying to do in my book. I wish I had his platform, but nevertheless, I'm trying to make it clear that for the 21st century, we've got two problems. One is climate change. The second one is the fate of the democratic capitalist system. Both of those need to be understood at the level of threat that they pose.
Yeah, it's fascinating to me that you choose climate change as the example, because that's a perfect example of everything that's right and everything's wrong with the system as it's kind of ended up. Because, again, Al Gore's film was, I would think, what, 16, 17, 18 years ago, that Inconvenient Truth was published. And, you know, the divide around climate change has become even broader. There is such dogma on both sides of that particular argument. And we've seen this again with COVID. You can find a credentialed scientist who can make the case for global warming being the massive problem that general population accepts it now to be. And you can find credentialed scientists that will say, this has happened before and it's nothing to worry about and it's, you know, it's not a problem. And we had the same with COVID. The world splits into these two completely polarized opposite sides about these big issues. And because of that kind of fraying of democracy, and when I use the democracy in this term, I mean, is it more of kind of what we've come to accept as civilized society where debate and discussion is encouraged and embraced? The climate change issue is an issue which threatens the world in half the population's eyes. And it is a big government construct that is science got run amok on the other side. And so as soon as you insert government into one of these issues as the potential solution, what you end up with in the case of climate change are things like Germans shutting off their last three nuclear reactors last week, which right now is a catastrophically foolish thing to do. But it's part of the green agenda, and so they're going to go through with that. And so when you bring that kind of decision-making from government into something like democratic capitalism, I worry that by handing the solution to lawmakers, even though it's a lawmaker's job, we again run into the divide in society and it becomes a cause and it becomes something that I can make headlines here, like Liz Warren, who famously attacks every financial institution she can. But oftentimes underneath what she's saying, it's kind of flimsy. And I don't know that people understand the problem well enough. Your book, I think, goes a long way to helping explain what a significant problem this is. But I worry that once you say, okay, lawmakers, over to you, deal with this, they're going to take it in all the wrong directions and all the wrong ways and use it for all the wrong purposes. And I just despair whenever the solution is government, because as we've seen over the years, I think, it doesn't often work out quickly and effectively like it did in the Patriot Act.
I sympathize with where you're coming from. My first goal is to get the issue deeper into the consciousness in the hopes that people who are decades younger than me can then carry the issue forward into a legislative accomplishment. But I can't do more than simply get the issue on the table, talk to the issue as best I can, and hope that future generations will get the point. I think the democratic capitalist system is under serious threat. I have lived under dictatorships. I don't want to see authoritarian regimes proliferate. I think in the United States, we've had our brush with authoritarianism, and it's not necessarily completely over yet. But I want the democratic capitalist system to survive and prosper. I will admit, some people in Europe have argued with me that democratic socialism is the way of the future. You know, the difference between democratic capitalism and democratic socialism is only about 15% of GDP. That is to say, the United States government to GDP, government revenue is about 30-35% out of GDP. In Scandinavian countries, it's above 50%.
50, yeah.
So we're talking about a difference of maybe 15% in the ratio between democratic capitalism and democratic socialism. In other words, I don't see much difference. Even the Scandinavian countries, which regard themselves as democratic socialist societies, have vibrant capitalist activities. So I honestly don't see that much difference between the two systems. You can call it democracy and free markets if you want to. It's the same thing. So I want democracies and free markets to survive. I'm deadly concerned that the way we are practicing the free market side of that equation right now is punitive and destructive to the democracy side of that equation.
I think that's a perfect way to sum it up. I think when you look at it, free markets are what built these great democracies. You know, the democracies were built upon free markets, and that is what we've gotten away from. And if you're going to fix democracy, you have to fix their foundations first, which is free markets. And, you know, I think what you've captured in the book, you've done a fantastic job of outlining the problems and talking in the end about how to deal with them. And, you know, this last hour has been just a fascinating insight to that, Raymond. I can't thank you enough for taking this time to talk to me. I found both the book and this conversation absolutely riveting, as I'm sure many other people will. So perhaps you can let people know a little bit more about the book, about where to find it, about where to find out more about the various projects you have going and the initiatives you've started, because I think there'll be plenty of people listening to this that will want to get more involved.
Invisible Trillions, most easily available on Amazon, whether the hard copy or the ebook or the spoken version of the book, it's easy to come by. The book seeks to lay out this problem as clearly as possible. And I've been accused all my life of trying to write with clarity, and that's what I try to do in this book. It covers a lot of ground, but the whole purpose of this book is to take these issues that I'm dealing with, elevate them to a higher level, and make it clear that we're dealing with an existential threat. There is a book website. I have an author website. I'd be more than happy to communicate with your listeners and strike up a conversation, either through email or LinkedIn or what have you. By all means, read the book and tell me what you like and what you question, and let's have a go at it.
Fantastic. Raymond, listen, my thanks to you for this time. I've thoroughly enjoyed it, and hopefully we can get this discussion out there a little bit more in the broader sphere, because I think it's just such an important discussion to have. So thank you again.
Thank you, Grant. My pleasure entirely.
Well, there you have it, folks. Another fantastic conversation. So, so interesting to listen to what Raymond had to say. The book is Invisible Trillions: How Financial Secrecy is Imperiling Capitalism and Democracy and the Way to Renew Our Broken System. It's available now from Amazon and just about every other good bookseller that you can think of. And I'm extremely grateful to Raymond for taking this time to talk to me. That's all from me for another episode. I'll be back soon with another guest. In the meantime, thank you as always for listening. Nothing we discussed should be considered as investment advice. This conversation is for informational and hopefully entertainment purposes only. So, while we hope you find it both informative and entertaining, please do your own research or speak to a financial advisor before putting a dime of your money into these crazy markets.